Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here, and let's get on into it. How are you today? What's going on? So I think you might have noticed it's not the weekend. I've decided I want to try to record sometime in the middle of the week, and I haven't settled on day yet. So it might be Thursday if this works, but not committed. But this is a drastically different day for me. In my week, generally, Sunday is kind of like my Sabbath. I call it my Sabbath, even though I'm not Christian in any way, shape, or form. But I do try to hold to this lack of activity, or at least an attempt at rest, if anything. And that's not today. I worked all day. I've been up since 4:30. I'm wired on the day, I guess, but I feel good, and I'm feeling good about this, so we're going to get on into it. I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but I got a cat, and her name is Shifu, and she's even was down by my feet just a little bit ago. She's real weird, though, and she's been really scared, and she's been hiding in my couch, and Odin's been really butthurt because he thought is going to be his new friend to play with, and that's not this cat. This cat just hides in the couch 99% of the time. She's really fat. But she's cool, and I am committed to her already. I love her. And the fact that she was walking around in the middle of the day, even though it is my room, is crazy. And the other night, when I was watching TV out in my living room, I even saw her start to walk out into the living room, which was nuts, you know? Like, she didn't even eat for like a week. So I have faith that eventually we will get to a point where we will be a happy family and Odin will no longer have hurt feelings over the cat's affinity for him. But one day. So my show, The Gingerbread Man, who is me, I'm here to try to cultivate and facilitate two main ideas. The first one being active creativity, or just creativity. And what I mean by that word and what's embedded in it is this idea of living creatively, which means choosing choices in our lives and noticing how much potential and how much control we have over everything that happens to us. Every single day, a bajillion things happen to us, and we are making ourselves in the act of living that life. And I see that as an artistic expression, and I think that is so lovely. And within that comes building meaning, and meaning systems are unique to each individual. So I don't try to push any sort of narrative or any ideology, even though, of course, my own ideology is my own ideology, and so I understand the oxymoron of that statement, but I'm not pushing Christianity or Hinduism or science or quantum physics, or I'm not trying to push anything onto you. What I'm trying to push is for you to go out and look for something or look at the common denominator amongst many things and be able to make a creative meaning system for yourself. Which I feel is what I've done, and that's what I try to share here. And I want to inspire that in others. And the other main idea that I try to lean on is this idea of unconditioned love. And I think love is the thing that all bits of life on this planet shares. And I know that there is a lot of things that appear to be ugly in nature, but when I think of love, I think of the interconnectedness of everything. And for humans, that pushes us to take care of and to try to be compassionate. And there's this idea of benevolence and humility. And so I think that comes from a space inside all of us. And it's polarly opposed, but not diametrically so, to this conditioned form of love where you love somebody in a desiring, needing way, where the love, the action when you try to go interact with what's outside of you, the world, when you're trying to get something from it, that's a desire and conditioned love. Whereas when I think of unconditional love, I think of how when we're interacting with this same world, we're trying to give to it. It's not exactly needing something to fill us. And so the example here would be like a really shitty relationship where you're in a toxic codependent relationship, and that's because you've decided that you want to, would rather be with this idea rather than by yourself. That's conditional. Whereas the love I have for this cat is completely unconditional. Even though she's fucking weird, I don't think I could ever get rid of her because I just love her so much. And like the love for my son, I mean, he's frustrating, but I would fight to the end of the world for him, you know, and I'm not needing anything from him. This is something I'm just completely just going to be giving, you know, but within giving, it's reciprocative. And so when we give to the world, I think we start to see synergies. We start to see contingencies arise. And I think the world starts to give back. And I think I've rambled on enough. That's about it. That's what I'm trying to do here. So today, I want to speak about one of my favorite topics. I guess this will kind of just be a refresher course. Hopefully it'll just capture some attention of some new viewers. And what I want to talk about today is psychedelia. And this is a big hot button topic in our world because we are currently in what I believe is the second renaissance of the counterculture movement here in America, especially. But I bet you that we live in a global enough world now that whatever's happening here in my country, I bet you there's resonances in all the other places. And you can reach out to me if you're from another country, and I would love to hear your story. And if you reach out to me in an email, I would even share whatever input and output that you have about what you think about what I'm speaking about. Even if you disagree, that'd be great. And that email address is thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. And then you can also find that in the show notes, but please reach out to me. But I really do believe that we're in this second upsurge because within culture, throughout all of history, there is the movement and then there's the counter movement. The counter movement's by the counterculture. But once the counterculture moves in, that's the new mainstream movement. And so then, of course, you're going to have another one come out, and that's going to be the new counterculture. So it's like a wave. We picture this back and forth, back and forth. And so after the 60s and the early 70s here in the United States, there was an intense withdrawal because a lot of people, I'm sure, were scared of how a lot of people really did tune in and drop out, like Timothy Leary tried to tell people to do. And they forgot their SIP codes, as Ram Dass said, you could if you put all, if you didn't figure out what your plan was before you went into being nobodiness. You know, like, so I think the culture, the uber mind, the group mind that rules all the big groups of people around the world, I think there was this fear, you know, because you see all the kids growing up and the kids are, some of them didn't turn out too well because they didn't spend a lot of time doing anything but getting high and, you know, partying. And so you have a lot of really restrictive legislature that comes in and restricts the use of these compounds, which were freely available and like not even regulated during the 50s. You know, and then during the 60s, you see this upsurge in use in the colleges and in therapeutics and science. Honestly, there's a lot of like scientific studies that are being done. MK Ultra, which is the CIA studies, not studies, CIA molestations of unbeknownst prison peoples and other people who are slipped Mickeys of LSD. You know, so like, and then right after this, going into the late 70s, early 80s, everything is just pounded down and you have super hardcore laws put in place. You have the war on drugs started, Reaganomics, Nixon's fucking shit, you know, the Vietnam War, and everybody's broke and hungry and afraid, you know, and so everything just gets hammered down. And I think right now is when it's starting to swing back around into this free will sort of living where the solidarity of human minds is being pushed and the celebration of experimentation is being more tolerated. And not only that, but industry is behind it. You know, you see how medical cannabis dispensaries built, I'm sure, just millions of dollars in tax revenue for what all the states that legalized. You know, alcohol is becoming legal in stores and all the places where it used to be prohibited. And that's happening with psychedelia now too. It really is. Where there's even loopholes where you can find psilocybic mushrooms and all kinds of research chemicals that are loosely regulated if they're not analogued. And it's super easy and available. You know, even head shops, gas stations have all these weird, loosely regulated research chemicals. But the classic ones that I've always found of interest that I'll briefly mention here are psilocybin, which breaks down into psilocin. And these compounds are made by various species of mushrooms throughout the world. Almost most, maybe not all, but most indigenous cultures from history, I feel, have some exposure to some form of psilocybin, at least in pockets, maybe if not all. You know, it's not in Antarctica, of course. I don't know if there's any Australian mushrooms, but I bet you there are. I think it, as a function to make this compound, these organisms start making it, and I'm sure they co-evolved it in several different locations around the planet. It seems to be a very ubiquitous compound used by fungus. And the way that it happens to interact with the human brain might just be happenstance, even though you have widely known speakers like one of my favorites, Terrence McKenna. He thought the mushroom had a consciousness when speaking to him, but I think that's a little far. But as with all things, there's a spectrum here, and you could figure out where you want to put your belief systems on how much this means. The stoned ape theory was another thing made by Terrence McKenna. And it's this idea that you had all these forests starting to dry up, especially in like African mainland where the Sahara Desert starting to form. And all of a sudden you have all these apes, like these Australopithecans, or these our ancestors, who were tree going or at least forest going, but now they don't have as much tree terrain. So now they're walking around in these plains and these fields. And because their environment has changed, you know, larger creatures start to evolve more, and larger mammals, you know, there's a lot of large fucking mammals in Africa. And this is just a theory. I'm not saying that's what I believe. I think it's kind of a stretch. But all of a sudden you have large mammals shitting everywhere. And most psilocybin mushrooms are dung lovers, even though there are wood lovers and other different kind of weird mushrooms. But, you know, the typical cubensis is something that grows on cow dung a lot of the times. And now people grow it out of grain, and it's been found that it's not very picky when it comes to its food source. It'll eat almost anything. I've seen it grow on a Bible. But so Terrence's main theory is basically that these Australopithecans found cubensis mushrooms growing on all of these turds, and somehow the substance impacted these creatures so profoundly that it jump-started their evolution towards being a modern human. Psilocybin is closely related to the serotonin molecule, and serotonin has a lot of roles in the body, and I'm not going to even claim to say I understand any of those, you know, and of course, it's also going to have a lot of other functions on other neurotransmitters as well. And these psilocybin mushrooms are not just containing psilocybin and psilocin. They also have bisdosin and norbisdosin and all these other synergistic things that are working together, just like all the functionary compounds of cannabis. But being structurally related to the serotonin molecule, it has a partial affinity for the 5-HT2A, which is a serotonin receptor. There's other ones too. And these serotonin receptors, they exist all throughout your body, but in high concentrations in your brain and in your stomach. Most of the serotonin that's created by your body is made in your gastrointestinal tract. So that comes down to diet and perhaps bacteria. But it's its close similarity that gives it this action in some way. Why it subjectively feels the way it does and has so much variability based on set and setting, which is a very, very important concept when it comes to this whole world of using these compounds, is looking at where we are mentally and physically in the world. And that's going to have the most profound impact on what you get out of using these substances, because they are tools. There's nothing endemically in a material that is the subjective experience. What you experience after you take anything is still fully you. You're just bent and muddled, perhaps. But I think people put way too much pretext and way too much importance on the substance itself when it is an interaction. And the most important part is looking at how you are interacting and looking at all these weird parts about how you might not usually be able to see these pieces of consciousness. All right, moving on. So another classic psychedelic that a lot of people would talk about is my favorite, DMT, which DMT also closely resembles the serotonin molecule. DMT is ubiquitous across hundreds of species of plants. A lot of the acacias and Mimosa hostilis is another good alkaloid containing DMT plant, but there's probably a lot more that we don't even know that exists. I have a feeling that it's just another one of these actions that the plant does, just like the mushroom, that it just has co-evolved all across the world. Yet again, when we look back into history and look at the cultural use of plant entheogens, which is plant-based medicines that have an effect and are could be psychoactive, is another word. But you can find use across varying different cultures. Like you have yopo seeds in South America and bee capi vine, and that used to make into ayahuasca. And there's a lot of different types of ayahuasca brews throughout South America. But I bet you could find DMT plants in Asia too. And they're all over Australia. And DMT has been used by the Aborigines of Australia for thousands of years. So you have this cultural use, but then it's synthesized. And then a good extraction method is developed in the 1900s. And that's where, you know, I've been looking into and learning about clandestine sort of home-based extraction techniques, which you could find information on that online yourself. And like in my state, Colorado, it's decriminalized to an extent. And so it's relatively easy and soft as far as, you know, darker, not dark. It's not even dark. I feel like I'm making fucking magic. So, but now all of a sudden you have freebase DMT, which freebase DMT is a different kind of pop than the ayahuasca beverage, because the ayahuasca brew is something that makes people purge. There's all of these physical body load sort of sensations that go with it. Something I still want to do, I haven't done. But then the freebase is like 5 minutes, and it's usually pure dimethyltryptamine, and there's relatively little body load, and it has a hard time staying in your body. Because what makes the ayahuasca brew special is the use of an MAOI inhibitor that allows the DMT to stay in the system for an exponentially longer time than it can on its own. Whereas when you freebase it, it hits your brain and then it falls out. It's like you have a leaky sieve, you know, or like you're draining pasta and the pasta water falls through the bottom. That's your brain, and the DMT has no way to stay inside the brain. But it's still a profound experience, and I like the shortened action and the fact that it isn't something that is such a long, prolonged thing. I think it has a lot of uses emotionally, behaviorally, Like, I've used DMT for several years when I'm in frustrated states, and I found that it helps me achieve different perspectives when I'm stuck in a negative one. Whereas if I'm taking psilocybin mushrooms and I'm high for 6 to 7 hours, I'm going to be in that place for a long time. And if I fall into a negative spill, sometimes it's hard for me to dig my way out. Because yet again, like I mentioned earlier, set and setting are profoundly important. So, yeah, moving on. All right, so LSD would be another classic psychedelic. And just like DMT and psilocybin, it has this affinity for the 5-HT2A receptor, which is a serotonin receptor. And so it has a very similar action to the other two. But yet again, it has a different package, and it's very different. And it has an affinity for dopamine. So LSD is very stimulating. It's super, super, super upbeat, and it's hard to sleep. You know, like, I take it at 5 o'clock in the morning exclusively, or else I'd be up all night, you know. But it has a different outlook. It's a different flavor than the other two that I was mentioning earlier. And I think it has, yet again, its particular uses. All three do in different ways. But I have the least amount of experience with LSD because I don't work good with stimulants. And so I usually take it in very small amounts. Whereas I pushed the envelope with psilocybin and DMT on multiple occasions, and I feel I have a lot more experience with the parts of my subconscious that are achieved using these tools. All right. The last classic psychedelic, which I have no experience with because I've just never had a good enough dose, and it hasn't ever been around. It's not as popular, but I know it exists out there, and one day maybe I'll figure out how to extract it myself, is mescaline. So mescaline is a phenethylamine, which is chemically similar to things like PCP and other stimulating compounds, and not really familiar on its method of action, but I think it does hit serotonin, but it does a lot of different things. And again, no experience, highly curious. Maybe there'll be more around in the world as we go into this new space in human culture and history. All right. Now, along with these classic ones, you have bins and analogs where these have been chemically distorted into other new novel compounds. One of my favorites would be 4-acetyloxine DMT, 4-ACO-DMT, also called acetylsilocin or psilocetin. There's a lot of names. And what it is it's an acetylized version of psilocin. So it breaks down into psilocin just like psilocybin does, but it starts at a different starting point and it has a different metabolization channel. There we go. So it's like taking a different road to the same place. So you're going to have a slightly different view, you know? But these things are loosely regulated and is pseudo-legal in a lot of parts of the country, especially if you don't say exactly what's in the chocolate bar at the head shop. And so a lot of these magic mushroom chocolates that I've seen in head shops, I'm fairly certain are 4-ACO-DMT. And also available to be found online, not even on the dark web, because yet again, it's loosely regulated. Not for all countries, of course, but the United States is mainly what I'm speaking about here, and primarily my local laws. So maybe I'm talking out of my ass. So don't take any of this as recommendations for doing anything at all. You don't need to do anything at all, but just open your mind to the ideas. And anything I've said about legal shit, it has nothing to do with your country if you're not from the United States. All right. Last disclaimer on that point. All right. So with the big bad internet opening up and becoming this thing where people like me who are interested in the organic extraction part of it, which has nuance in some ways, and just talking about other organic chemistry things that I don't even understand. There's a lot of Facebook groups and blogs. There's been blogs for decades, like Arrowid and Blue Light and DMT Nexus would be a great DMT one. But now, like, openly on Facebook and social media, there's all these pages where a lot of like-minded people, I've talked to a lot of people from Britain, a lot of people from Australia, who have been doing similar techniques with the same plants, so we're able to have conversations about this technical process, even though we're separated by thousands of miles. And it's been lovely to have this community, almost. It feels like kind of like a broad community across the world. And I like learning about what other people's projects are and interests are. But I would like to spend a little bit of time at the end of this episode to really speak about an issue that's been bugging me, because, like, and to a point where I need to be careful, because I've been getting too revved up and aggressive and angry. And I'll get into arguments with people online that don't need to be had, where I'm obsessed and, like, you know, fucking, I'm looking at my phone too much because I want to respond to these assholes. Like, I love arguing online, but it's a terrible, terrible habit. It's worse than cigarettes. But there's a lot of scammers on the internet, and it's going to get worse. And it's not like back in the day where you're getting hacked. It's all social engineering, which I saw a documentary a couple years back on this, where just using chat functions in Facebook, these people were able to get complete credit card informations and, like, steal whole bank accounts from people just from talking to them and figuring out important details like their first and last name, age, date of birth, kids' names, be able to break in, and then they'll call and, like, act like they're you. And so, like, you know, to the point of being stolen from on the internet, I just want to say that I don't want that to happen to anyone. And primarily the way that I see the internet and social media is as a amazing place to communicate. Like, and there's this, like, unfortunate hole that people can fall into on social media where you say you have, like, this person who doesn't have access and they badly want to try these things, you know, and they're not in Colorado. That's super illegal. You know, and you have to go deal with a fucked up drug dealer and, you know, like, go into a black dark alley to find some shit. You don't want to do that. And all of a sudden, you know, fucking Tommy Chong with a fake ass picture on Facebook talks to you and direct messages you and says, hey, I can get you anything you want for incredibly low prices. All you gotta do is PayPal or Cash App me $200 and I can get you this or this or this or this. And you're like, oh my God, I don't have to go down the street or do anything. You just mail it to me. And then you send the money and you never get your money back. And I almost did it one time when this first started ramping up, because even 2 years ago, I didn't see a lot of this, or at least I wasn't in the right groups or something. But right now, it's disgusting. Like, any group that has any psychedelic context that isn't incredibly moderated, and, like, the moderators and administrators are deleting people, like, nonstop, and has to be private, you know, and then they'll still sneak in and they'll start scamming, where it's just, it's terrible. And the PSA for today is you can't get any substances on Facebook. It's impossible. I want you to spread the word. Like, don't ever do it if you ever are getting interested in any of these things and you just want to learn. If you've never done it and you just want to talk to people, like-minded people, and you're in a comment section, and then a stranger says, I can get you any of these things. And then there might be a Twitter handle or an Instagram handle at the bottom, and it'll always be like this chat GPT sort of fucking text where it's just like, go to this place and whatever. Don't click it. And what I do is I always write underneath it, scammer. And then I try to alert a moderator on whatever page it is. But yeah, it's really frustrating. And I just have this sick feeling in my stomach that a lot of people are having their money stolen. You know, a lot of hopeful people. There's a wealth of information out there and community aplenty, but always be wary with your wallet. All right, before I go find Odin and let him give you his advice to the world from his wise little mind, I want to read a little bit from Alan Watts. This is his The Joyous Cosmology, Adventures in the Chemistry of Consciousness. which is his very ambiguous take on psychedelia. And I think a lot of it was written while he was under the influence, which gives it a certain flavor. And there's all these beautiful pictures interdispersed through all of his descriptions and text. It's a lovely book. It's short, too. I think I need to read it again, because it's one of those weird ones. But here goes. I'm looking at what I would ordinarily call a confusion of bushes, a tangle of plants and weeds, with branches and leaves going every which way. But now that the organizing relational mind is uppermost, I see that what is confusing is not the bushes, but my clumsy method of thinking. Every twig is in its proper place, and the tangle has become an arabesque, more delicately ordered than the fabulous doodles in the margins of Celtic manuscripts. In this same state of consciousness, I have seen a woodland at fault, with the whole multitude of almost bare branches and twigs in silhouette against the sky, not as a confusion, but as the lacework or tracery of an enchanted jeweler. A rotten log bearing rows of fungus and patches of moss becomes as precious as any work of Cellini. An inwardly luminous construct of jet, amber, jade, and ivory, all the porous and spongy disintegrations of the wood seeming to have been carved out with the infinite patience and skill. I do not know whether this mode of vision organizes the world in the same way that it organizes the body, or whether it is just the natural world is organized in that way. A journey into this new mode of consciousness gives one a marvelously enhanced appreciation of patterning in nature, a fascination deeper than ever with the structure of ferns, the formation of crystals, the markings upon seashells, and incredible jewelry of such unicellular creatures of the ocean as the radiolaria, the fairy architecture of seeds and pods, the engineering of bones and skeletons, the aerodynamics of feathers, and the astonishing profusion of eye forms upon the wings of butterflies and birds. All this involved delicacy of organization may, from one point of view, be strictly functional for the purpose of reproduction and survival. But when you come down to it, the survival of these creatures is the same as their very existence. And what is that for? More and more it seems that the ordering of nature is an art akin to music, fugues and shell and cartilage, counterpoints and fibers and capillaries, throbbing rhythm and waves of sound, light, and nerve, and oneself is connected with it quite inextricably, a node, a ganglion, an electronic interweaving of paths, circuits, and impulses that stretch and hum through the whole of time and space. The entire pattern swirls in its complexity like smoke and sunbeams or the rippling network of sunlight and shallow water. Transforming itself endlessly into itself, the pattern alone remains. The cross points, nodes, nets, and curlicues vanish perpetually into each other. The baseless fabric of this vision is its own base. When the ground dissolves beneath me, I float. Closed-eyed fantasies in this world seem sometimes to be revelations of the secret workings of the brain, of the associative and patterning processes, the ordering system which carries out all our sensing and thinking. Unlike the one I have just described, they are for the most part ever more complex variations upon a theme. Ferns sprouting from ferns, sprouting from ferns in multidimensional space. Vast kaleidoscopic domes of stained glass or mosaic, or patterns like the models of highly intricate molecules. Systems of colored balls, each one of which turns out to be a multitude of smaller balls. Forever and ever, is this perhaps an interview of the organizing process, which, when the eyes are open, makes sense of the world, even at points where it appears to be supremely messy. Boom. He says it so well. And that's really kind of like, at least what I see in that is this idea that we're looking at how we're perceiving the world, which goes back to the beginning of the show when I'm talking about how we live creatively. And if we can tell ourselves a narrative that is any narrative that we so desire, we can make it happen. And psychedelia sort of breaks down the organizational structures. It puts a distance and it puts a space between the rational, intellectualizing section of our consciousness. And we start to be able to swim in the abyssal nature, this infinite space that I think is attached to love and the universe and all of its intricacy. And that is far removed from the little captain's chair and seat that you and I always sit in. And we steer left and we steer right and we say yes and we say no and we make decisions, which is what I'm advocating for. I say we should. I think we should be creative and do that. But recognize how small of a room that is. And there's a lot of existence in feeling. There's a lot of existence in living. There's a lot of existence in perceiving. And when we make choices, we experience new things. And that's interacting with the world. And that's kind of what I think this whole subject of psychedelia is about. Things to think about. You don't have to be high to watch your actions and to take notes on your life and its circuitous nature. But like I said earlier, if you have any interest in these things, which I do think are tools of a nature to help us further investigate their exploratory axes and boots with high bootstraps or whatever the fuck boots have. And the best part about adventuring and experimentation is when we're confident with our tool use, we can do amazing things as humans. So that's the challenge. Go live. Go be loving. I think that's about it for my yarn tonight. So thank you for being here with me. I appreciate you. You're why I'm here. I'm going to go find Odin, and then we'll say bye.
Hello! It is Ask Owen the Gingerbread Man. How are you guys doing? It's been a long time since I talked to you guys.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What you working on out there?
So, I've been gaming.
I saw a helicopter.
Yes, so.
Do you like flying helicopters?
Yes.
Are you a helicopter dude?
Yes, I am really a helicopter. Well, how are you guys doing?
I think they're great. Yeah. We're all just thinking about lives and stuff.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
What do you think about choices?
Choices.
Isn't it kind of crazy that there's so many things that could happen at any moment?
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
It's kind of scary sometimes, huh?
Yeah.
But that's what, where we have
like, control. If you think of bad choices, like, it's bad. And then if you, like, think of good choice, it's a good way to be good.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's possible to think about them ahead of time?
Yeah.
You can practice and plan, at least to an extent. Yeah. I think you're cool. I think you make good choices a lot of the time. Not gonna lie. You make great choices sometimes.
Yeah. Ow. Cool. You know what I just did?
Huh.
So I was walking around.
Mm-hmm.
I stepped on a piece of, like I stepped on like a piece of Lego and I already got a rub burn.
Oh, jeez.
And now I am like, like that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on. I love you, bud.
Goodbye.
Talk to you later.